This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. After 6 years, WMFE's president and general manager LaFontaine Oliver is moving on, heading to Baltimore to lead NPR member station WYPR. I sat down with LaFontaine to talk about the challenges of leading a public radio station in a rapidly changing media landscape.
Well, LaFontaine Oliver, tell me one thing that you're going to miss about this station.
Just one thing. That's going to be difficult. I'm going to miss a lot about this station. I'm going to miss the people, I think, first and foremost, just a wonderful staff, everyone from, the folks in the newsroom to the folks doing production and engineering and back office stuff, HR, fundraising. It's just a great group. So I think first and foremost, I'm going to miss the people, over the course of 6 years, and you get to know folks and you get to you get pretty close. So and I think I like to think we're kind of a tight-knit family. So
what did you learn about Orlando in your time here that kind of changed your opinion about the place?
Well, I certainly learned, like most people, that there is so much beyond the theme parks and so much, kind of beyond the hospitality industry and travel and tourism, that, they're just these wonderful pockets and neighborhoods with all sorts of unique things, happening and, the sights, the sounds, the taste of a community. I mean, I think that's what I learned that, has certainly changed the perception, I had prior to moving here about the areas that, it's like any other community. It's, it's nuanced. It's it's got its unique traits. I'm gonna miss some of that.
It's changed quite a bit in the last 6 years too.
It has, and that's the other interesting thing is just the pace at which growth and change has happened in the last 6 years. I mean, just this area where our offices and studios are located. I mean, the amount of growth and change that's happened in this area. And when I arrived, there was no Dr. Phillips Performing Arts Center. And,
right.
That pace has just been wonderful, which is great because I think it speaks to the growth that's happening here in the community and in the region. And that's really exciting.
You've shared a little bit with the staff at WMFE your reasons for moving back to your hometown, Baltimore.
One of my hometowns.
One of your hometowns, sure. But
yeah.
I wonder if you can share a little bit with our listeners, like the rationale for the move.
Yeah, so they call us the sandwich generation. So we kind of have our kids on one end, and then we have our parents on the other end. And this just sort of started to make sense as we started kind of experiencing the challenges that come along with parents who start to age and. I won't get into the specifics, but that's been, a bit trying for my family. And, this gives us an opportunity to be closer to those folks and to take a more active role in taking care of them. And so that really was a big part of this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I know that was not an easy decision for you because you are so close to the WMFE family and the broader listenership who gets so much out of WMFE.
Yeah, I mean, I've been telling folks the toughest decision I think I've had to make in my life to date, not just thinking about professional, but in my personal life, because my wife and I we love it here, and we plan to be very frequent visitors. We have two little ones who are one already in college here and another, I keep calling them little ones.
Right, not so little anymore.
Yeah. And one that will be starting school in the fall here. And that will keep us frequent visitors. We really do love it here. And it made it very difficult. And the other thing that made it so difficult was, beyond just the relationships with staff. I mean, our members and our major donors and just folks that I've connected with them. I sit on a number of boards, and so you know, that's going to be tough. But I, as I said, I hope to be a frequent visitor and hope to still be able to in some way be a part of the community while we, you know, we transition.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So what can you tell me about the job you'll be moving into?
Wow. So WYPR, so the NPR news station there in Baltimore, Maryland, and it's a great station with a great staff. I got an opportunity to meet them the last 2 days. They're doing some really interesting stuff, not only coming out of their newsroom for broadcast, but doing some interesting things in the podcast space. And they've not been around as long as MFE has been around. Of course, MFE is coming up on its 40th anniversary, so they've not been around as long. But, man, have they really hit the ground running, and they've accomplished so much. They were previously licensed to Johns Hopkins University, mm-hmm. and they were once WJHU. But just a great station and a great community, a community that, you know, needs a really strong public radio station right now as they go through a number of challenges. You know, in the national news has been, you know, the fact that their mayor resigned, and they've had some pretty big stories. So just a number of things. But you have there a station like MFE here in Central Florida that's on the pulse of that. And, mm-hmm. You know, I'm looking forward to doing everything that I can to contribute there to help them continue to grow and continue to be successful and serve that community in a big way.
Do you feel like in a place like Baltimore, you have a better kind of handle on who the audience is? Because in a place like Orlando, the growth is so, you know, fast that sometimes I wonder if it's hard to sort of figure out where the next batch of listeners is coming from. I'm wondering what it's like compared to Baltimore.
Yeah, it you hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's a much more stable sort of you know, kind of audience profile, so to speak, there. And then I have an advantage, you know, having grown up in the area, more specifically in Washington, D.C., which is, don't get me wrong, is very, very different from Baltimore. But having spent time there and then having run a station in Baltimore for a little over 6 years, that certainly gives me a leg up as it relates to, you know, kind of understanding the audience. But things change. A lot has certainly changed there as well. And, you know, part of what I will be doing, as I did, you know, here is an extensive listening tour to really get a sense of what's happening not only within the station, but more specifically in the broader community, so that I'm sure that we are doing, continuing to do the right things in order to serve the audience there. Mm-hmm.
Quite a lot has changed in media too. I mean, we're talking about the change that's happened in the city of Orlando itself and the greater Orlando area. But I mean, think about 6 years ago, we weren't talking about smart speakers and, you know, to hear Morning Edition or All Things Considered play, ask your smart speaker to play it.
Yeah.
Now we are. How do you think public radio, whether it's WMFE or other member stations or even NPR itself, is dealing with these changes in the media landscape?
Well, I think by and large, we're doing well dealing with it in that, you know, we're not sort of sticking our head in the sand and saying, you know, no, this is not happening. And we are terrestrial FM, AM and FM broadcasters. And that's what we're going to do. I think most of us have accepted the fact that, you know, we need to meet our audiences where they are. We need to stake claim to every platform where they may roam. And that means we have to be flexible. Mm-hmm. We have to understand that, you know, as this thing moves more the direction of bits and bytes on the internet and away from terrestrial broadcast, that means we have to reexamine how we do things. And I think, you know, I think we've recognized that here at MFE and started to make adjustments. And I was certainly pleased to see that there in Baltimore at YPR, they They have as well. And, you know, on a national level, you know, I'm, you know, on the NPR board and, you know, have an opportunity to kind of from a different vantage point to kind of look at trends in the system. And I can tell you nationally, NPR is thinking about that. And, you know, NPR helps to pull the system along, you know, with them. You know, they just recently announced some new initiatives that will allow for more content to smart speakers coming from local member stations without any work to come from the member stations, which is great. They are nationally the biggest player in the podcast space, which is great for local member stations. It helps pull us along. It helps induce that sampling. It helps bring in a younger, more diverse audience into the public radio tent. I think we all are realizing that, you know, our business is changing, and I think we're doing a pretty good job of embracing it. Now, I will say we are up against some competitors that are well funded and able to make lots of investments and move really quickly. So we have to be really intentional and really strategic about how we do things. But I'm pleased to see that we are making the adjustments necessary to meet our audience, you know, where they are.
Are you seeing other media outlets or even other organizations in general kind of borrowing from the public media model of fundraising and sort of sustainability?
Yeah. We certainly are seeing that. And, you know, it's an interesting thing to sort of witness, because I think sometimes in public media, we don't value or don't quite understand the value in our model, which is that, you know, we give our product away every single 365 days a year. We work hard to produce something of quality and, you know, what I call high thread count type of content, and then we give it away.
And now you're saying that's a bad thing?
No, but it's a different model. Mm-hmm. We give it away and, you know, our audience then, if they find value in it, they assign a value to it and they support us. And I think sometimes we lose track of the fact that that's actually a really powerful model, and it connects us to our audience and the folks that use what we produce in a different way. I mean, there's no paywall there. There's no mandatory subscription amount or, you know, monthly fee in order to get this. And it is interesting now to see that others are picking up on that and saying, you know, maybe there's something to this. And, you know, we've been doing it for, you know, 50 years now or you know, maybe a little more. And so that is an interesting change that, you know, there are some, you know, for-profit media organizations that are now thinking about this model. So,
LaFontaine Olivier, before you were in public radio, public media, you came up through commercial radio, right?
Yeah, I spent some time in commercial radio. I spent some time in satellite radio as well. Yep.
Do you see more kind of porousness between commercial and public media now? Like, you know, NPR or member stations, are they sort of borrowing something from commercial radio and vice versa, or are they still two pretty distinct models and different sounding products?
You know, I think they are still pretty distinctive. I mean, certainly there are markets that you may travel to where, you know, there's a bit more closeness in the presentation, but I still think they're pretty distinctive. You know, there was a time where the thought was, you know, what happens on public radio happens there because it's not commercially viable. Mm-hmm. I think that is what has changed, because when you look out into many markets, you will see that the NPR news station is competing with the commercial formats and in a big way. And that says that gone are the days where, well, that end of the dial is for those things that are not commercially viable or that are more niche, or, you know, I think that's what has changed. I mean, there, you know, we do very well here in Orlando, and continue to get even better. And whether you're talking about, you know, formats like the NPR News format or, you know, the public radio jazz format or the public radio classical format or the AAA format, you know, there are examples where, you know, these stations are really, really taking off and commanding large shares of their local audience.
Where do you see public radio fitting into the media landscape amongst a climate of mistrust of the media in general?
Yeah, you know, I think that is where we have an opportunity to really shine, and I think that is where what we can attribute some of our recent ratings success to, because, you know, we say sometimes, you know, we do it without the slant and the rant, and I think people want that, and I think people need that, and they are searching for that, and as you know, things get more complicated in our world from any number of standpoints. I think listeners are now gravitating more towards not only a presentation style, but a presentation that puts an emphasis on timely, accurate information. That is not meant to polarize or not meant to do anything other than to inform the audience and to respect their intelligence to figure out what that information means to you. I think it was Mark Twain who said, you know, a lie can travel halfway around the world before the truth can even get its shoes on. Mm-hmm. I think that's very true in today's environment, especially when you look at whether it's what's happening on social media. People need to know where they can reliably go and get facts, because facts are the building blocks for truth. And you need truth in order to then get to a real understanding about, you know, what are the nuances of an issue and how do those things. And so you got to start with the facts. And I think one of the recent NPR campaigns said, we stand with the facts, and that's what we hope to do. So I think that has allowed for stations like WMFE to thrive, because people have come to rely on that, and that's a big responsibility for our stations to sort of make good on that promise to deliver.
You mentioned a couple of the big stories in Baltimore. Your future home, the WYPR we will be moving to, we've gone through quite a lot here in Orlando too in the last 6 years. I mean, experiencing the Pulse nightclub shooting, hurricanes, other things too. What sticks in your mind, and what do you think of as, you know, some of the areas where WMFE has been able to make an impact in presenting news on some of those big issues?
Yeah, you know, certainly the Pulse tragedy. You know, I could not have been more proud of, you know, how this station reported on and contributed through that reporting really to the healing that needed to happen here in the region after the Pulse tragedy. So that certainly stands out. You also mentioned the hurricanes. And so the other thing I would point to is, you know, our relationship with the other public broadcasters here in the state, and the fact that we've been able to develop this Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, which really puts us on the front line of emergency preparedness and being able to give our community the information they need during those times of inclement weather and storms and things like that. I think that's been really powerful and something that has developed, you know, since my time here. And then just some of the other work that has happened with the various content verticals. I mean, you know, what Brendan is doing now as it relates to space, and this, and certainly this station has had, you know, a history going back as it relates to that. But it just feels really, really good to see, you know, him continuing in that tradition, and just, you know, becoming the go-to guy as it relates to, you know, what's happening in space travel. And then, you know, what Amy Green is doing, not only reporting on issues affecting our environment here in Central Florida, but, you know, how those tentacles then reach out and sort of touch other parts of the state, and how we can then work with other stations on environmental reporting. I mean, that those are some things that I think are really special, and I think are going to continue to be, you know, important going forward. The work that Abe's doing and has been doing, you know, around, you know, our health and healthcare reporting, and some mm-hmm. of the enterprising work he did around PTSD and some of that stuff. And then Matthew, the fact that, we've been able to grow the footprint of Intersection, which, you know, is really kind of the flagship program now, the place where we have the most amount of consistent real estate in a long form way to be able to explore issues that are of concern to folks here in Central Florida. And so, yeah, I mean, I could go on and on. There's just lots of good stuff going on here. And you guys are really, really hitting your stride as it relates to being able to be a primary source for news and perspectives here in Central Florida. And I'm really, really proud of that.
What would your advice be to whoever it is who steps into your shoes as general manager and president of WMFE?
You know, I guess it would be first and foremost to do what I did when I arrived here and what I plan to do in Baltimore, which is to take some time to listen, to listen to the community, to listen to the staff here, because I think there's a great staff here that knows what they're doing and are really thoughtful about their work. And I think it's important for a leader to be able to listen and then inventory your thoughts and then figure out where you can make an impact. I often would say when I first got here, you know, part of my job is just not to mess up things. And so, you know, sometimes, you can get to fixing things that maybe don't need to be fixed and break something else along the way. And so certainly I hope that, you know, the next person will be able to sort of put their fingerprint on the place get their vision executed. But I think it has to start with listening to the community. And I think it has to start with listening to the wonderful folks that are here doing great work. You know, one of the other things that I've mentioned is, you know, sometimes it's just, you know, your job is to clear the way so that, you know, folks can run as far and as fast as they possibly can. And I think that's something at least I've been able to do in some way here.
You kind of have broadcasting in your genes, right?
Yeah.
Looking back on it, obviously, this is kind of a moment in your career, but would there be anything you would have changed, or do you ever sort of have that moment where you think, man, I wish I could have done something different?
So my first love before radio was actually acting. And so I literally grew up in the theater and, you know, I did some TV work and some independent film. And sometimes I do think about, I wonder, you know, what that would have been like if I had taken that turn instead of this turn. But aside from that, the work that I've done from a broadcast standpoint, I don't know that I would have changed anything. I mean, I've been very, very fortunate because at a very, very early age or early in my career, I mean, I've experienced just some wonderful things and, you know, everything from, you know, working on startup types of situations where you're, you know, either launching local programming or national programming or national programming services, to the transition to public, you know, the time I spent in satellite, the opportunities that I've had to help with initiatives aimed at diverse audiences. I've just been really, really fortunate to work on some great projects. And so I don't know from a broadcast standpoint that I would change anything. But I will say every now and then I think about, you know, how much in particular the theater, how much I loved performing. And so I do think about that from time to time.
Well, LaFontaine Oliver, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Matthew.
Still to come on Intersection, incoming Orange County Fire Chief Jim Fitzgerald joins us for a conversation about the changing role of the firefighter and changing attitudes to keeping firefighters safe. Intersection's back in a minute.
Can I kick it?
Yes, you can.
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 Can I kick it?
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Jim Fitzgerald became a firefighter when he was 18, following in the footsteps of his grandfather. He's been in the fire service for some 42 years, and in what he calls one of the proudest moments of his career, he's been named Orange County Fire Chief. Fitzgerald sat down to talk with us about the challenges facing the fire department and the recent firefighter cancer bill.
Well, I started in the fire service when I was 18, and one of my proudest days in the fire service was 1981. I was one of the founding members of the Orange County Fire Department through the abolishment of a number of fire control districts. At midnight on 6-1 of 81, we became Orange County Fire Rescue. So I was one of a few hundred firefighters at that moment, probably the proudest I've ever been in the fire service up until 2 weeks ago when I was called into the office of our mayor and offered the position of a lifetime, and that was to be the next Orange County Fire Chief.
So Orange County has grown a lot. I imagine the responsibilities of the fire department overall have grown considerably too with the growing population.
We are one of the largest departments in the state of Florida, and I think the 25th or 26th largest in the U.S. We have some 1,363 members strong. We cover all of unincorporated Orange County, and we also provide services, fire and EMS, and dispatch services to several of the municipalities within Orange County as well. We respond to over 129,000 emergencies a year. An average normal day for us is somewhere in the 300 calls for service. So that was yesterday. Yesterday, 300 calls for service, and 191 patients were treated and transported. That's pretty much a typical day.
So most of your calls are on the EMS, sort of medical emergency side of things, or like what's the split between fire and other emergencies?
Traditionally, large metro departments like ours see a higher incidence of EMS calls. So we're about probably 80% on the EMS side. Mm-hmm. So we are the largest pre-hospital care provider in Central Florida. So that's almost 4,000 patients a month, or 60-plus thousand patients a year, are treated and transported by us to area hospitals. So it's a significant part of what we do, and that's why we have the number of ALS, Advanced Life Support Rescues. And some people don't know that all of our engines, the traditional fire trucks, also have a paramedic. So mm-hmm. when that fire truck arrives to you, and you may have called for a rescue, if that fire truck arrives first, it also has a paramedic and all of the necessary equipment to treat you for whatever particular condition you may have.
So a big county and a department as busy as yours, what are the challenges you're heading into here?
Growth and keeping up with growth. If you travel about the county, each day, you certainly know how quickly Orange County is growing. We also enjoy some 70 million visitors each year, and I think with an average stay of 2 to 3 days, it's quite a number of guests mm-hmm. that are here every day, as well as the 800 or so thousand individuals that live here. Growth appears to be one of the challenges that we work on quite a bit in plotting new fire stations and hiring new firefighters to meet those challenges.
Do you have the resources, or is the county giving you the resources to hire the offices you need and build the stations you need?
In fact, they are. Just 2 weeks ago, we opened our newest fire station, Fire Station 44, out in the Horizons area. We have three other stations that'll be coming on board within the next year and a half. We'll be building a new station up off of Avalon later this year, and then the beginning of next year we'll have another station down off South Goldenrod that'll be coming online. Those will be two brand new stations to support our efforts. And then there are two or three more stations to be built in the future in the Horizons area out west, where we've seen tremendous growth.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty talking to Jim Fitzgerald. He is the incoming Orange County Fire Chief.
So, as you say, growth is one of the challenges, and making sure you have the firefighters and the stations sort of in the right kind of places. What about working with other fire departments too? Because growth in Central Florida sometimes can be, you know, encompassing a city here, a county here. Like, how much flexibility and coordination is there between, say, Orange County and Osceola County Fire Department, or some of the city fire departments as well?
We enjoy tremendous support from the other agencies, both within Orange County as well as the surrounding counties for Orange County. We have automatic aid and mutual aid agreements that allow for services to go back and forth. We're also a part of a large statewide automatic aid and mutual aid component. You know, Florida, we have our share of hurricanes and disasters, and Florida has done an excellent job in emergency management in coordinating the efforts of these departments so that we can send resources back and forth as needed.
I want to ask you about a recent bill that was passed in the legislative session that just ended, the bill which addresses cancer in firefighters. Do you think that bill does what it needs to do to give those firefighters what they need?
Absolutely, without a question in my mind. It is groundbreaking legislation for the Florida Fire Service. Up until this point, heart and lung issues had been ones of great concern to us. But cancer now has surpassed heart and lung issues for firefighters. Cancer is the leading cause of death for firefighters. This legislation was groundbreaking and will provide the support and the financial support through insurance to allow these individuals, these firefighters, to really focus on treatment and getting better and not have to worry about the financial downfall when one of these illnesses can take hold.
So explain how that works, because my understanding is the bill doesn't have any, you know, state funding attached to it. Is that right?
That's correct. So funding will be by way of local jurisdictions. And when you think every day that these firefighters put their lives on the line for you and myself and my family, honestly, it's the very least that we can do. It's extending insurance coverage so that these individuals won't have to pay out-of-pocket expenses if they succumb to one of these illnesses.
For example, in the case of Orange County, it would be on the county to provide the insurance coverage that these firefighters might need.
That's correct. It'll be worked within our health insurance program. It is not to be seen as a workers' comp, a traditional workers' comp. The state legislature has moved that so that it will be dealt with through your health insurance.
So, I mean, given the fact that, you know, in the case of Orange County, it is such a big fire department, is that going to put some financial pressure on the department, factoring in this new sort of addition to the insurance plan that you have?
I suspect that there will be some additional cost to us, and I would also submit, you know, that we will gladly pay that. One in three firefighters will come down with cancer. It is now 9% of the firefighting population will come down with cancer, 9% more than the general population. 14% of the firefighters will succumb to cancer more than the general population. It is a serious threat to the nation's fire service, and extending this coverage is honestly, it's the right thing to do. I think in the, you know, for the future, for the firefighters in the future that are diagnosed, it will give them hope, because they'll know that we've had their backs in providing this coverage to them, and their families won't have to suffer financially as they go through their treatment. And I think it's also very, very important to understand that as firefighters, as the nation's fire service, it's also incumbent upon us to try to reduce and eliminate cancer going into the future. And we are doing that by being very proactive in the cleaning of our protective clothing. Cancer occurs because of the carcinogens within the soot that's created after a fire that get on the firefighter's protective clothing. And then it gets into the pores in their skin. And over time, you know, this is attributable to them getting cancer. So what we do now is we clean. As soon as we come out of a fire, we do gross decontamination to remove those carcinogens from the protective clothing. We have hoods now and gloves that try to prevent the soot from getting into the pores.
That's probably a big change from when you were coming up as a young firefighter.
It's huge. 30 years ago, the dirtier the gear, the better. Hmm. And it was almost a badge of honor. Today, the badge of honor is clean gear. We promote it. We have standard procedures. We've provided equipment. We have two sets of gear. All of our firefighters have two sets of gear. So when they come out of a fire, all of that gear goes into a bag after being deconned and will go to be laundered and then be brought back to them. So we're doing everything we can in the hopes that we can stem the tide of cancer. But it is a serious threat to the firefighters of today. And, mm-hmm. and I couldn't be happier with the legislation and the cancer presumption bill for them.
What about the department's approach to active shooter scenarios? Because that is something that is, you know, it's across the country, right? And a lot of departments have had to kind of rethink the way they approach those, when to send officers and what kind of equipment they might have. What can you tell me about what you have now and what might change as far as your approach to those active shooter scenarios?
Well, I think we can all think back and remember that horrific day in Columbine with all of those students being killed. Mm-hmm. That was really a significant change in law enforcement and the fire department's approach. We have had now for the last several years a program in place where we work with law enforcement and we team up and go into those active shooter scenario situations with our paramedics. And it, as they clear a room and that room is then left to the firefighters and the paramedics to come in behind and extract anybody that may be there bleeding or hurt. But we are actually moving in with law enforcement as they attempt to engage. We're no longer waiting outside. The equipment that we provide to the firefighters is completely different than years ago. We have ballistic vests for all of our firefighters, ballistic helmets. We have specialized kits that they bring in to lessen the degree of bleeding so that we can extract the patients very, very quickly. Law enforcement and the firefighters are moving through these buildings very, very quickly, and they're simply trying to stop the bleeding and extract the wounded. Mm-hmm. But it is a program that we've had in place now for several years. We've had a number of scenarios this year. We've practiced with UCF and the UCF police. We've practiced with the City of Orlando and the Orlando Police Department, as well as the Orange County Sheriff's Office. So it is a program that we're on top of. It's a shame that it's come to this, but we are prepared for the challenge.
And you mentioned Columbine, of course, Orlando. We think of the Pulse nightclub shooting almost 3 years ago now. Do all of your firefighters have the capability to go into that situation, or is it certain members of the crew who might be deployed to do that, or is it basic training that every single firefighter would get?
It's basic training, universal training for everybody on the department. The vests and the helmets are on all of our apparatus, so as soon as they step off in one of those situations, they're putting their vest on and they're putting their ballistic helmet on, and they're ready to go. And we go in as teams as we go through these buildings, searching mm-hmm. for victims to rapidly extract.
It's quite a lot to ask of a firefighter, right?
Changing times. But again, it's very important that we keep up in those changing times. Mm-hmm. And we are up to the challenge.
What made you want to become a firefighter?
Now, my grandfather was a career firefighter in Worcester, Massachusetts in the 30s. And just hearing his stories over time was something that got me interested in it. And I've been in the fire service for some 42 years now.
Well, Jim Fitzgerald, incoming Orange County Fire Chief, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Still to come on Intersection.
You have to embrace your mistakes. You can't just, you know, do the classic, type it up. If you don't like it, crumple it up and throw it away. If you make a mistake or you use the wrong word, you have to keep writing.
Nick Jorgudiou explains why he loves typewriters. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The 28th Orlando Fringe Festival is underway, the longest-running fringe theatre festival in the United States. Over the next 14 days, you'll hear music, laughter, applause, and this noise.
To find out why the clatter of typewriters is part of this year's Fringe Fest, we talked to the host of the Fringe Feels booth.
So, hi, my name is Nick Jorgudiu. I am the host of To a Certain Degree on WPRK, and this year I'm sponsoring a table at the Fringe Festival for people to show gratitude to the people who work there and all the performers.
So, Nick, just tell us what we're looking at here.
So you've got a couple of typewriters here. I started collecting them, and this was my first one. It's a Royal Arrow, probably from the 1940s. So the classic all-black typewriter comes in a case, can go through just about anything and keep ticking. And then a little bit of a more recent one, Smith Corona Classic 12. This is probably from the 60s or 70s. And I just love the typewriters. It's really easy to find them through Facebook or a Craigslist or at a thrift shop and pick them up and make sure that they're working and use them for all sorts of things.
When did you start collecting typewriters?
It was about 2 years ago. It was a project on kind of showing gratitude. It was to help me show more gratitude in life. And my handwriting is terrible, so I realized that if I wanted to send notes to people, I would have to get a typewriter. And so I got it, and I ended up started doing analog Yelp reviews. So I would actually send the Yelp review to the business that I really appreciated and not expect anything in return. So it was like this exercise in showing gratitude without expecting things. And so that's where it all started, and it blossomed from there.
But why not just print out a letter from your computer?
It's just not the same. What I found was once I got the typewriter is you have to embrace your mistakes. You can't just, do the classic, type it up. If you don't like it, crumple it up and throw it away. If you make a mistake or you use the wrong word, you have to keep writing. So it became this really interesting exercise in writing as well that I think has made me a better writer.
Do you think, though, some people are into typewriters just because it's kind of cool and they don't like is there an element of I'm jumping on a typewriter bandwagon here, if that's possible to mix that metaphor?
I love the idea of the typewriter bandwagon because it's just so weighed down by these heavy typewriters. They're, it's interesting because they're easy to find, and I think that for kids especially, I bring my typewriters out when I talk to kids about 3D printing and makerspaces. So I'll bring a typewriter and a 3D printer, and they're equally fascinated with both. So I don't know if anybody's jumping on this as a bandwagon. I hope so, because maybe I can unload some of the 8 or 10 typewriters that I currently own. If anybody wants, no, I'm just kidding. I'm never going to get rid of them.
So Nick Jorgudiu, you mentioned the 3D printer as well. I know that's part of kind of what you do. Is there an analogy between making something as in creating something physical like a letter or a poem or a thank you note and doing it on a typewriter and printing something in 3D?
I think it is. I think it's having an artifact at the end. It's something that you've produced. So that was kind of the idea behind what I'm doing for the Fringe Festival this year. And what happened was I had this very fortuitous conversation with a couple of the people who work at Fringe. I said, I have these typewriters. I would love to do a table where people could show their own gratitude to the people who are performing, to the volunteers, and to the staff at the Fringe Festival, all the people who put this amazing world-class event on every year in Orlando. And they were super happy about it. And so I went out to the Fringe does a preview event. I went out there, so I got to interact with people and kind of try it out, see what works, see what didn't work. And people were a little bit cautious at first. They were seeing typewriters and wondering what that was all about. And then once they realized I had people coming up and interacting and writing thank you notes, of which I have a few examples here.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about these notes. What do we got?
Yeah, so a few notes here. Some people have really nice handwriting, so they just decided to write their own. But what I brought was cards and then some die-cut paper, some shaped as rainbows or unicorns or foxes. So people can get really creative with this. But again, the idea is that just take a minute, stop by if you're at the Fringe Festival and there's air conditioning. I'll be in the rep lobby. You can stop by and type up or write up or draw a note for somebody at the Fringe Festival. Mm-hmm. So something you've seen or a volunteer who helped you or just in general, thank you guys so much for putting this on.
Now, one of them we're looking at here is a cutout card. It's like a pink rainbow. Mm-hmm. Just explain what we're reading, because you were talking about the beauty and mistakes that you sometimes get with typewriting. This bottom note here, what does it say?
Yeah, it says, great job. Keep up the good work. Couldn't have done it without you. And AP signed... signed AP. I'm not going to try to read that, that okay. signature. But, you know, so she's getting used to, it was fun to watch people do it because they're getting used to how the space bar works. On some of the manual typewriters, this was written on one of the manual ones, you really have to jab at it in order to get it to actually print, to get the letter to come out. So you can see in some of them, some of the letters come out fairly lightly. Spaces are missing. It looked like she tried to hit the shift and put a quarter in there and a comma instead of an apostrophe. But it's just so cool to look at and see that, you know, again, someone not only took the time, but did it on something and had the experience of doing it on something they're not used to doing it on.
So let's hear these machines and see them in action.
Yeah, so what I'm going to do is on the Royal, I like writing on the cardstock, so I'll buy blank cards for the most part. And what I find is when you have a very limited amount of room, you tend to write more honestly and not necessarily quickly. It sometimes takes me a while to write it, but it comes to you a little bit more quickly. So I'll just write a quick note to you. Can I call you Matt?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, great. Something like that. So, Matt, thanks so much for having me out to the WMFE studios. I really enjoyed talking with you, and I know you enjoyed speaking with me. So I would just take it from there.
It's kind of mesmerizing watching those little arms fly up and down as you bash the keys, right? And seeing the letters emerge underneath.
The noise is cathartic. So is the actual, you know, you really have to smash at the keys to an extent, or jab, I should say. So it's not just a matter of pressure. It's like just these quick jabs you have to do in order to get the ink to stick and for it to really stay.
Can you imagine what it must have been like in an old newsroom back before the advent of the computer?
So, yeah, so all this noise, plus everybody's chain smoking, right? It would be fun for a little bit. I would like to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there.
What about the other typewriter you've got over here? What's the difference between these two?
Yeah, so this is a newer model. So this is a Smith Corona. So you hear the Royal. Again, you really have to jab on that one. And it's got the, you know, the classic glass keys and things like that. This is a more modern, still some metal on it, but a lot more plastic. And a few more accoutrements, if you will. You can change the color. So you have a dual ribbon here. And so this one will actually print in pink instead of the black, the classic black. So we could do that one.
Now, just a note of clarification here. When was the Royal made?
This is probably from the 30s or 40s.
And what about the classic?
More than likely from the 60s or 70s. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of see the translation and the transition in terms of, you know, you have color, you have a lot more things that are associated with it. For example, like the different types of ribbon and things of that nature. So it's really neat to see the differences between the two.
Well, Nick Jorgadio, thank you so much for coming in and bringing your typewriters and showing us how it's done.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Paola Chinchilla. Production assistance for today's show from Danielle Pryor. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. Help us complete our Spring Silent Drive, make a contribution, and become a sustaining member by calling 1-800-785-2020 or going online to wmfe.org/support. This Thursday, we're taking Intersection on the road, and we hope you can join us for a celebration of Central Florida musicians called Tiny Desk Contest Orlando Favorites at the Abbey in downtown Orlando. It's free, and it'll feature interviews with and performances by Chloe Hogan, Blackberry, Amanda Lynn, and Seek and Find. Learn more and RSVP at wmfe.org/tinydesk. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.